eyes glistened. Unable to find a hotel one night, he had slept on the ground, awaking the next morning to find himself beneath an olive tree. Mr. De Silva had never forgotten that tree. They had had a meaningful exchange, the two of them. Olive trees are intimate creatures, eloquent in their twistedness. It's easy to understand why the ancients believed human spirits could be trapped inside them. Mr. De Silva had felt this, waking up in his sleeping bag. I was curious about Greece myself, of course. I was eager to visit. Mr. De Silva encouraged me in feeling Greek. "Miss Stephanides," he called on me one day, "since you hail from Homer's own land, would you be so kind as to read aloud?" He cleared his throat. "Page 89. That semester, our less academically inclined sisters were reading A Light in the Forest, but in the greenhouse we were making our way through the Iliad. It was a paperback prose translation, abridged, set loose from its numbers, robbed of the music of the ancient Greek, but, as far as I was concerned, still a terrific read. God, I loved that book. From the pouting of Achilles in his tent, which reminded me of the president's refusal to hand over the tapes, to Hector's being dragged around the city by his feet, which made me cry, I was riveted. Forget love story. Harvard couldn't match Troy as a setting, and in Seagal's whole novel, only one person died. Maybe this was another sign of the hormones manifesting themselves silently inside me. For while my classmates found the Iliad too bloody for their taste, an endless catalogue of men butchering one another after formally introducing themselves, I thrilled to the stabbings and beheadings, the gouging out of eyes, the juicy eviscerations. I opened my paperback and lowered my head. My hair fell forward, cutting off everything. Maxine, Mr. De Silva, the greenhouse's geraniums, except the book. From behind the velvet curtain, my lounge singer's voice began to purr. Aphrodite put off her famous belt, in which all the charms of love are woven, potency, desire, lovely whispers, and the force of seduction, which takes away foresight and judgment, even from the most reasonable people. It was 1 o'clock, and after-lunch lethargy lay over the room. Outside, rain threatened. There was a knock at the door. "Excuse me, Calais, could you stop for a moment, please?" Mr. De Silva turned toward the door. "Come in." Along with everyone else, I looked up. Standing in the doorway was a red-headed girl. 2 clouds bumped up above, skidding past each other, and let down a beam of light. This beam struck the glass roof of the greenhouse, passing through the hanging geraniums. It picked up the rosy light, which now, in a kind of membrane, enveloped the girl. It was also possible that the sun wasn't doing this at all, but a certain intensity, a soul ray from my eyes. "We're in the middle of class, dear." "I'm supposed to be in this class," said the girl unhappily. She held out a slip of paper. Mr. De Silva examined it. "Are you sure, Miss Durrell, once you transferred into this class?" he said. "Mrs. Lamp doesn't want me in her class anymore," replied the girl. "Take a seat. You'll have to share with someone. Miss Stephanides has been reading from Book 3 of the Iliad for us." I started reading again. That is, my eyes kept tracing over the sentences, and my mouth kept forming the words, but my mind had stopped paying attention to their meaning. When I finished, I didn't toss my hair back. I let it stay, hanging over my face. Through a keyhole in it, I peeked out. The girl had taken a seat across from me. She was leaning toward Ritika, as though to look on with her, but her eyes were taking in the plants, her nose wrinkled up at the mulchy smell. Part of my interest was scientific, zoological. I'd never seen a creature with so many freckles before. A big bang had occurred, originating at the bridge of her nose, and the force of this explosion had sent galaxies of freckles hurtling and drifting to every end of her curved, warm-blooded universe. There were clusters of freckles on her forearms and wrists, an entire Milky Way spreading across her forehead, even a few sputtering quasars flung into the wormholes of her ears. Since we're in English class, let me quote a poem, Gerard Manley Hopkins' Pied Beauty, which begins, "Glory be to God for dappled things." When I think back about my immediate reaction to that red-headed girl, it seems to spring from an appreciation of natural beauty. I mean the heart pleasure you get from looking at speckled leaves or the palimpsested bark of plane trees in Provence. There was something richly appealing in her color combination. The ginger snaps floating in the milk-white skin, the gold highlights, the strawberry hair. It was like autumn looking at her. It was like driving up north to see the colors. Meanwhile, she remained slumped sideways in her desk, her legs with the blue knee socks shoved out, revealing the worn heels of her shoes. Because she hadn't done the reading, she was exempt from being called on, but Mr. Da Silva sent concerned looks her way. The new girl didn't notice. She sprawled in her orange light and sleepily opened and closed her eyes. At one point she yawned, and halfway through cut the yawn off as though it hadn't gone right. She swallowed something back and pounded a fist against her breastbone. She burped quietly and whispered to herself, "Ay caramba!" As soon as class was over, she was gone. Who was she? Where had she come from? Why had I never noticed her in school before? She was obviously not new at Baker and Inglis. Her Oxfords were stamped down at the heels so that she could slip into them like clogs. This was something the charm bracelets did. Also, she had an antique ring on her finger with real rubies in it. Her lips were thin, austere, Protestant. Her nose was not really a nose at all. It was only a beginning. She came to class every day wearing the same distant, bored expression. She shuffled in her Oxford clogs with a gliding or skating motion, her knees bent and her weight thrust forward. It added to the overall desultory impression. I would be watering Mr. Da Silva's plants when she entered. He asked me to do this before class. So every day began like that. Me at one end of the crystal room engulfed by geranium blooms and this answering burst of red coming through the door. The way she dragged her feet made it clear how she felt about the weird old dead poem we were reading. She wasn't interested. She never did the homework. She tried to bluff her way through class. She hacked up the quizzes and tests. If she'd had a fellow charm bracelet with her, they could have formed a faction of uninterested note passers. Alone, she could only mope. Mr. Da Silva gave up trying to teach her anything and called on her as little as possible. I watched her in class, and I watched her outside it, too. As soon as I arrived at school, I was on the lookout. I sat in one of the lobby's yellow wing chairs, pretending to do homework, and waited for her to pass. Her brief appearances always knocked me out. I was like somebody in a cartoon with stars vibrating around the head. She would come around the corner, chewing on a flare pen and shuffling as if wearing slippers. There was always a rush to her walk. If she didn't keep her feet digging forward, her crushed-down shoes would fly off. This brought out the muscles in her calves. She was freckled down there, too. It was almost a kind of suntan. Sliding, she charged by, talking to some other charm bracelet, both of them moving with that lazy, confident hauteur they all had. Sometimes she looked at me, but showed no recognition. A nictitating membrane lowered itself over her eyes. Allow me an anachronism. Louis Bunuel's That Obscure Object of Desire didn't come out until 1977. By that time, the red-headed girl and I were no longer in touch. I doubt she ever saw the movie. Nevertheless, That Obscure Object of Desire is what I think about when I think about her. I saw it on television in a Spanish bar when I was stationed in Madrid. I didn't catch most of the dialogue. The plot was clear enough, though. An older gentleman, played by Fernando Rey, is smitten with a young and beautiful girl, played by Carol Bouquet. I didn't care about any of that. It was the surrealist touch that got me. In many scenes, Fernando Rey is shown holding a heavy sack over his shoulder. The reason for this sack is never mentioned. Or if it is, I miss that too. He just goes around lugging this sack into restaurants, cabs, city parks. That was exactly how I felt, following my own obscure object. As though I were carrying around a mysterious, unexplained burden or weight. I'm going to call her that if you don't mind. I'm going to call her the obscure object, for sentimental reasons. I also have to protect her identity. There she was in gym class, malingering. There she was at lunch, having a laugh attack. Doubled over the table, she tried to hit the joker responsible. Her mouth bubbled milk. Her nose leaked a few drops, which started everyone laughing harder. Next, I saw her after school, riding double with an unknown boy. She climbed up on the bicycle seat while he stood on the pedals. She didn't put her arms around his waist. She managed the thing by balance alone. This gave me hope. One day in class, Mr. De Silva asked the object to read aloud. She was lounging in her desk as usual. At a girls' school, you didn't have to be so vigilant about keeping your knees together or your skirt tugged down. The object's knees were spread apart, and her legs, which were somewhat heavy in the thigh, were bare high up. Without moving, she said, "I forgot my book." Mr. De Silva compressed his lips. "You can look on with Callie." The only sign of agreement she gave was to sweep her hair off her face. She placed a hand to her forehead and ran it back like a plow through her hair, her fingers leaving furrows. At the end of the stroke came a little flick of the head, a flourish. There was her cheek, permitting approach. I scooted over. I slid my book onto the crack between our desks. The object leaned over it.
"From where?"
"Top of the page, 112, the description of the shield of Achilles." I'd never been this close to the obscure object before. It was hard on my organism. My nervous system launched into flight of the bumblebee. The string section was sawing away in my spine. The tympani were banging in my chest. At the same time, trying to conceal all this, I didn't move a muscle. I hardly breathed. That was the deal, basically. Catatonia without, frenzy within. I could smell her cinnamon gum. It was still in the back of her mouth somewhere. I didn't look directly at her. I kept my eyes on the book. A strand of her red-gold hair fell onto the desk between us. Where the sun hit the hair, there was a prismatic effect. But while I was witnessing the half-inch rainbow, she began to read. I expected a nasal monotone riddled with mispronunciations. I expected bumps, swerves, screeching breaks, head-on collisions. But the obscure object had a good reading voice. It was clear, strong, supple in its rhythms. It was a voice she'd picked up at home from poetry-reciting uncles who drank too much. Her expression changed, too. A concentrated dignity, previously absent, marked her features. Her head rose on a proud neck. Her chin was lifted. She sounded 24 instead of 14. I wonder which was stranger, the Eartha Kitt voice that came out of my mouth or the Katharine Hepburn that came out of hers. When she was finished, there was silence. "Thank you," said Mr. De Silva, as surprised as the rest of us. "That was very nicely done." The bell rang. Immediately the object leaned away from me. She ran a hand through her hair again as though rinsing it in the shower. She slipped out of the desk and left the room. On certain days when the greenhouse was lit just so and the obscure object's blouse unbuttoned two buttons, when the light illuminated the scapulars dangling between the cups of her brassiere, did Calliope feel any inkling of her true biological nature? Did she ever, while the obscure object passed in the hall, think that what she was feeling was wrong? Yes and no. Let me remind you where all this was happening. It was perfectly acceptable at Baker and Inglis to get a crush on a fellow classmate. At a girls' school, a certain amount of emotional energy normally expended on boys gets redirected into friendships. Girls walked arm in arm at B&I the way French schoolgirls do. They competed for affection. Jealousies arose, betrayals occurred. It was common to come into the bathroom and hear somebody sobbing in one of the stalls. Girls cried because so-and-so wouldn't sit by them at lunch or because their best friend had a new boyfriend who monopolized her time. On top of this, school rituals reinforced an intimate atmosphere. There was Ring Day, where big sisters initiated little sisters into maturity by giving them flowers and gold bands. There was the distaff dance, a maypole without men held in the spring. There were the bi-monthly heart-to-hearts confessional meetings run by the school chaplain, which invariably ended in paroxysms of hugging and weeping. Nevertheless, the ethos of the school remained militantly heterosexual. My classmates might act cozy during the day, but boys were the number one after-school activity. Any girl suspected of being attracted to girls was gossiped about, victimized, and shunned. I was aware of all this. It scared me. I didn't know if the way I felt about the obscure object was normal or not. My friends tended to get envious crushes on other girls. Ritika swooned over the way Alwyn Breyer played Finlandia on the piano. Linda Ramirez was smitten with Sofia Cracciola because she was taking three languages at once. Was that it? Was the crush I had on the object a result of her elocutionary talent? I doubted it. It felt physical, my crush. It wasn't a judgment, but a tumult in my veins. For that reason, I kept quiet about it. I hid out in the basement bathroom to think the matter through. Every day, whenever I could, I took the back stairs down to the deserted washroom and shut myself up for at least half an hour. Is there any place as comforting as an old institutional pre-war bathroom? The kind of bathroom they used to build in America when the country was on the rise? The basement bathroom at Baker & Inglis was done up like a box at the opera. Edwardian lighting fixtures gleamed overhead. The sinks were deep white bowls set in blue slate. When you bent to wash your face, you saw tiny cracks in the porcelain, as in a Ming vase. Gold chains held the drain stoppers in place. Beneath the taps, dripping had worn the porcelain thin in green stripes. Above each sink hung an oval mirror. I wanted nothing to do with any of them. The hatred of mirrors that begins in middle age started early for me. Avoiding my reflection, I headed straight for the toilet stalls. There were three, and I chose the middle. Like the others, it was marble, gray New England marble, 2 inches thick, quarried in the 19th century, and studded with fossils millions of years old. I closed the door and latched it. I took a safety guard from the dispenser and laid it over the toilet seat. Germ-protected, I lowered my underpants, lifted my kilt, and sat. Right away, I could feel my body relaxing, my stoop unkinking itself. I brushed my hair out of my face so that I could see. There were little fern-shaped fossils, and fossils that looked like scorpions stinging themselves to death. Down beneath my legs, the toilet bowl had a rust stain, ancient, too. The basement bathroom was the opposite of our locker room. The stalls were 7 feet high and extended all the way to the floor. Fossilized marble concealed me even better than my hair. In the basement bathroom was a time frame I felt much more comfortable with, not the rat race of the school upstairs, but the slow evolutionary progress of the earth, of its plant and animal life, forming out of the generative primeval mud. The faucets dripped with the slow, inexorable movement of time, and I was alone down there, and safe, safe. From my confused feelings about the obscure object, and safe, too, from the bits of conversation I'd been overhearing from my parents' bedroom just the night before. Milton's exasperated voice had reached my ears. "You still got a headache? Christ, take some aspirin." "I took some already," my mother replied. "Nothing helps." Then my brother's name and my father grumbling something I couldn't make out. Then Tessie. "I'm worried about Callie, too. She still hasn't gotten her period." "Al, she's only 13. "She's 14. And look how tall she is. I think something's wrong." Silence a moment, after which my father asked, "What does Dr. Phil say?"
"Dr. Phil? He doesn't say anything."
"I want to take her to someone else." The humming of my parents' voices from behind my bedroom wall, which throughout my childhood had filled me with a sense of security, had now become a source of anxiety and panic. So I exchanged it for walls of marble, which echoed only with the sound of dripping water, of the flushing of my toilet, or of my voice softly reading the Iliad aloud. And when I got tired of Homer, I started reading the walls. That was another selling point of the basement bathroom. It was covered with graffiti. Upstairs, class photos showed rows and rows of student faces. Down here, it was mostly bodies. Sketched in blue ink were little men with gigantic sexual parts and women with enormous breasts. Also various permutations. Men with dinky penises and women with penises, too. It was an education, both in what was and what might be. Over the gray marble, this new jagged etching of bodies, doing things, growing parts, fitting together, changing shape, plus also jokes, words to the wise, confessions. In one spot, I love sex. In another, Patty C. is a slut. Where else would a girl like me, hiding from the world a knowledge she didn't quite understand herself, where else would she feel more comfortable than in this subterranean realm where people wrote down what they couldn't say, where they gave voice to their most shameful longings and knowledge? For that spring, while the crocuses bloomed, while the headmistress checked on the daffodil bulbs in the flower beds, Calliope, too, felt something budding. An obscure object all her own, which in addition to the need for privacy, was responsible for bringing her down to the basement bathroom. A kind of crocus itself just before flowering. A pink stem pushing up through dark new moss. But a strange kind of flower indeed, because it seemed to go through a number of seasons in a single day. It had its dormant winter when it slept underground. 5 minutes later, it stirred in a private springtime. Sitting in class with a book in my lap, or riding home in carpool, I'd feel a thaw between my legs, the soil growing moist, a rich, peaty aroma rising, and then, while I pretended to memorize Latin verbs, the sudden squirming life in the warm earth beneath my skirt. To the touch, the crocus sometimes felt soft and slippery like the flesh of a worm, and other times it was as hard as a root. How did Calliope feel about her crocus? This is at once the easiest and the hardest thing to explain. On the one hand, she liked it. If she pressed the corner of a textbook against it, the sensation was pleasurable. This wasn't new. It had always felt nice to apply pressure there. The crocus was part of her body, after all. There was no reason to ask questions. But there were times when I felt that something was different about the way I was made. At Camp Ponchawang, I'd learned, on certain humid bunkhouse nights, of the bicycle seats and fence posts that had seduced my campmates at tender ages. Lizzie Barton, roasting a marshmallow on a stick, told us how she'd become fond of the post of a leather saddle. Margaret Thompson was the first girl in town whose parents owned a massaging showerhead. I added my own sense data to these clinical histories. That was the year I fell in love with gym ropes. But there remained a vague, indefinable gap between the stirrings my friends reported and the clutching ecstasy of my own dry spasms. Sometimes, hanging down from my top bunk into the beam of someone's flashlight, I would finish my little self-revelation with, you know? And in the dimness, three or four stringy-haired girls would nod once and bite the corner of their lips and shift their eyes away. They didn't know. I worried at times that my crocus was too elaborate a bloom. Not a common perennial, but a hothouse flower, a hybrid named by its originator like a rose. Iridescent Helene, pale Olympus, Greek fire. But no, that wasn't right. My crocus wasn't for show. It was in a state of becoming, and might turn out fine if I waited patiently. Maybe it happened like this to everybody. In the meantime, it was best to keep everything under wraps, which was what I was doing down in the basement. Another tradition at Baker and Inglis. Every year, the eighth graders put on a classical Greek play. Originally, these plays had been performed in the middle school auditorium, but after Mr. De Silva took his trip to Greece, he got the idea of converting the hockey field into a theater, with its bleachers set into the slope and its natural acoustics. It was a perfect mini Epidaurus. The custodial staff brought risers out and set up a stage on the grass. the year of my infatuation with the obscure object, the play Mr. De Silva selected was Antigone. There were no auditions. Mr. De Silva filled the major roles with his pets from Advanced English. Everyone else, he stuck in the chorus. So the cast list reads like this. Joanne Maria Barbara Paraccio as Creon. Tina Kubik as Eurydice. Maxine Grossinger as Ismene. In the role of Antigone herself, the only real possibility, from even a physical standpoint, was the obscure object. Her midterm grade had been only a C-. Still, Mr. De Silva knew a star when he saw one. "We have to learn all these lines?" asked Joanne Maria Barbara Paraccio at our first rehearsal. "In 2 weeks?" "Learn what you can," said Mr. De Silva. "Everyone's going to be wearing a robe. You can keep your script underneath. Miss Fagles will also be our prompter. She'll be in the orchestra pit." "We're going to have an orchestra?" Maxine Grossinger wanted to know.
"The orchestra," Mr. De Silva said, pointing to his recorder, "is I."
"I hope it doesn't rain," said the object.
"Will it rain the Friday after next?" said Mr. De Silva. "Why don't we ask our Tiresias?" And then he turned to me. "You expected someone else?" "No, if the obscure object was perfect to play the avenging sister, I was a shoo-in to play the old blind prophet. My wild hair suggested clairvoyance. My stoop made me appear brittle with age. My half-changed voice had a disembodied, inspired quality. Tiresias had also been a woman, of course, but I didn't know that then, and it wasn't mentioned in the script. I didn't care what part I played. All that mattered, all I could think about, was that now I would be near the obscure object. Not near her as I was during class when it was impossible to speak, not near her as I was in the lunchroom when she was spitting milk at another table, but near her in rehearsals for a school play, with all the waiting around that implied, all the backstage intimacy, all the intense, fraught, giddy, emotional abandon brought on by assuming identities not your own. "I don't think we should use scripts," the obscure object now declared. She had arrived for rehearsal looking professional, all her lines highlighted in yellow. Her sweater was tied around her shoulders like a cloak. "I think we should all memorize our lines," she looked from face to face. "Otherwise, it'll be too fakey."
Mr. De Silva was smiling. Learning lines would require effort on the object's part, a novel undertaking.
"Antigone has far and away the most lines," he said, "so if Antigone wants to be off book, then I think the rest of you should be off book too."
The other girls groaned, but Tiresias, already having a vision of the future, turned toward the object.
"I'll go over your lines with you, if you want."
The future. It was already happening. The object was looking at me. The dictating membranes were lifting.
"Okay," she said distantly.
We agreed to meet the next day, a Tuesday evening. The obscure object wrote out her address and Tessie dropped me at the house. She was sitting on a green velvet sofa when I was shown into the library. Her Oxfords were off, but she still had her uniform on. Her long red hair was tied back, the better to do what she was doing, which was to light her cigarette. Sitting Indian style, the object leaned forward, holding the cigarette in her mouth over a green ceramic lighter shaped like an artichoke. The lighter was low on fluid. She shook it and flicked the button with her thumb until at last a small flame shot out.
"Your parents let you smoke?" I said.
She looked up surprised, then returned to the work at hand. She got the cigarette going, inhaled deeply, and let it out slowly, satisfyingly.
"They smoke," she said. "They'd be pretty big hypocrites if they didn't let me smoke.
But they're adults. Mommy and Daddy know I'm going to smoke if I want to. They don't let me do it. I'll just sneak it." By the looks of it, this dispensation had been in effect for some time. The object was not new to smoking. She was already a professional. As she sized me up, her eyes narrowing, the cigarette hung aslant from her mouth. Smoke drifted close to her face. It was a strange opposition, the hard-bitten private eye expression on the face of a girl wearing a uniform for private school. Finally, she reached up and took the cigarette out of her mouth. Without looking for the ashtray, she flicked her ash. It fell in.
I doubt a kid like you smokes, she said.
That would be a good guess. You interested in starting? She held out her pack of Territons.
I don't want to get cancer.
She tossed the pack down, shrugging. I figure they'll be able to cure it by the time I get it.
I hope so, for your sake.
She inhaled again, even more deeply. She held the smoke in and then turned in cinematic profile and let it out.
You don't have any bad habits, I bet, she said.
I've got tons of bad habits.
Like what?
Like I chew my hair.
I bite my nails, she said competitively.
She lifted one hand to show me.
Mommy got me this stuff to put on them. It tastes like shit. It's supposed to help you quit.
Does it work?
At first it did, but now I sort of like the taste, she smiled.
I smiled.
Then briefly, trying it out, we laughed together.
That's not as bad as chewing your hair, I resumed.
Why not?
Because when you chew your hair, it starts smelling like what you had for lunch.
She made a face and said, Bogue.
At school, we would have felt funny talking together, but here no one could see us. In the bigger scheme of things, out in the world, we were more alike than different. We were both teenagers. We were both from the suburbs. I set down my bag and came over to the sofa. The object put her Territon in her mouth. Planting her palms on either side of her crossed legs, she lifted herself up like a yogi levitating and scooted over to make room for me.
I got a history test tomorrow, she said.
Who do you have for history?
Miss Schuyler.
Miss Schuyler has a vibrator in her desk.
What?
A vibrator. Liz Clark saw it. It's in her bottom drawer.
I can't believe it.
The object was shocked, amused. But then she squinted, thinking.
In a confidential voice, she asked,
What are those for, anyway?
Vibrators?
Yeah. She knew she was supposed to know, but she trusted I wouldn't make fun of her. This was the form of the pact we made that day. I would handle the deep intellectual matters, like vibrators. She would handle the social sphere. Most women can't have orgasms by regular intercourse, I said, quoting from the copy of Our Bodies Ourselves Med Zemke had given me. They need clitoral stimulation. Behind her freckles, a blush rose to the object's face. She was, of course, transfixed by such information. I was speaking into her left ear. The blush spread across her face from that side, as if my words left a visible trace.
I can't believe you know all this stuff.
I'll tell you who knows about it. Miss Schuyler, that's who. The laugh, the hoot, shot out of her mouth like a geyser. And then the object was falling back on the couch. She screamed with delight, with revulsion. She kicked her legs, knocking her cigarettes off the table. She was 14 again, instead of 24. And against all odds, we were becoming friends. Unwept, unfriended, without marriage song, I am led forth in my horror,
sorrow,
in my sorrow on this journey that can be delayed no more, no longer,
hapless one,
oh, I hate that, no longer hapless one may I behold yon day's star's sacred eye, but for my fate no tear is shed, no
friend makes moan.
No friend makes moan. We were at the object's house again, going over our lines. We were in the sunroom, sprawled on the Caribbean sofas. Parrots flocked behind the object's head as she squeezed her eyes shut, reciting. We'd been at it for 2 hours. The object had gone through almost a full pack. Beulah, the maid, brought us sandwiches on a tray along with 2 64-ounce bottles of Tab. The sandwiches were white, crustless, but not cucumber or watercress. A salmon-colored spread caked the spongy bread. We took frequent breaks. The object required constant refreshment. I still wasn't comfortable in the house. I couldn't get used to being waited on. I kept jumping up to serve myself. Beulah was black, too, which didn't make it any easier.
I'm really glad we're in this play together, the object said, munching. I would have never talked to a kid like you.
She paused, realizing how this sounded. I mean, I never knew you were such a cool kid.
Cool.
Calliope Cool. I had never dreamed of such a thing, but I was ready to accept the object's judgment.
Can I tell you something, though, she asked, about your part?
Sure.
You know how you're supposed to be blind and everything? Well, where we go in Bermuda, there's this man who runs a hotel, and he's blind. And the thing about him is, it's like his ears are his eyes. Like if someone comes into the room, he turns one ear that way. The way you do it, she stopped suddenly and seized my hand. You're not getting mad at me, are you?
No. You've got the worst expression on your face, Callie.
I do.
She had my hand. She wasn't letting go.
You're sure you're not mad?
I'm not mad.
Well, the way you pretend to be blind is you just sort of stumble around a lot. But the thing is, this blind man down in Bermuda, he never stumbles. He stands up really straight, and he knows where everything is, and his ears are always focusing in on stuff.
I turned my face away.
See, you're mad.
I'm not.
You are.
I'm being blind, I said.
I'm looking at you with my ear.
Oh, that's good. Yeah, like that. That's really good.
Without letting go of my hand, she leaned closer, and I heard, felt, very softly, her hot breath in my ear.
Hi, Tiresias,
she said, giggling. It's me, Antigone.
The day of the play arrived. Opening night, we called it, though there would be no others. In an improvised dressing room behind the stage, we lead actors sat on folding chairs. The rest of the eighth graders were already on stage, standing in a big semicircle. The play was set to begin at 7 o'clock and finish before sunset. It was 6:55. Beyond the flats, we could hear the hockey field filling up. The low rumble got steadily louder, voices, footsteps, the creaking of bleachers, and the slamming of car doors up in the parking lot. We were each dressed in a floor-length robe, tie-dyed black, gray, and white. The obscure object, however, was wearing a white robe. Mr. De Silva's concept was minimal. No makeup, no masks.
How many people are out there? Tina Kubek asked. Maxine Grossinger peeked out.
Tons!
You must be used to this, Maxine, I said, from all your recitals.
I don't get nervous when I'm playing the violin. This is way worse.
I am so nervous, the object said. In her lap she had a jar of Rolaids, which she was eating like candy. I understood now why she had pounded her chest the first day of class. The obscure object suffered from a more or less constant case of heartburn. It was worse during times of stress. A few minutes earlier, she had wandered off to smoke her last cigarette before showtime. Now she was chewing on the antacid tablets.
Part of coming from old money, apparently, was having old person habits, those gross adult needs and desperate palliatives. The object was still too young for the effects to tell on her. She didn't have eye bags yet or stained fingernails, but the appetite for sophisticated ruin was already there. She smelled like smoke if you got close. Her stomach was a mess. But her face continued to give off its autumnal display. The cat eyes above the snub nose were alert, blinking, and resetting their attention to the growing noise beyond the flats.
There's my mom and dad, Maxine Grossinger shouted. She turned back to us and broke into a big smile.
I'd never seen Maxine smile before. Her teeth were jagged and gappy like those of a Sendak creature. She had braces, too. Her unconcealed joy made me understand her.
She had a whole other life apart from school.
Maxine was happy in her house behind the cypresses. Meanwhile, curly hair gushed from her fragile musical head.
Oh, Jesus! Maxine was peeking out again. They're sitting right in the front row. They're going to be staring right at me.
We all peeked out, each in our turn. Only the obscure object remained seated.
I saw my parents arrive. Milton stopped at the crest of the slope to look down at the hockey field. His expression suggested that the spectacle before him, the emerald grass, the white wooden bleachers, the school in the distance with its blue slate roof and ivy, pleased him. In America, England is where you go to wash yourself of ethnicity. Milton had on a blue blazer and cream-colored trousers. He looked like the captain of a cruise ship. With one arm on her back, he was gently leading Tessie down the steps to get a good seat. We heard the audience grow quiet. Then a pan flute was heard, Mr. De Silva playing his recorder. I went over to the object and said, "Don't worry, you'll be fine." She had been repeating her lines silently to herself, but now stopped. "You're a really good actress," I continued. She turned away and lowered her head, moving her lips again. "You won't forget your lines. We went over them a billion times. You had them down perfect yesterday." "Will you stop bugging me for a minute?" the object snapped. "I'm trying to get psyched up." She glared at me. Then she turned and walked off. I stood watching her, crestfallen, hating myself. Cool! I was anything but. I'd already made the obscure object sick of me. Feeling as if I might cry, I grabbed one of the black curtains and wrapped myself up in it. I stood in the darkness, wishing I were dead. I hadn't just been flattering her. She was good. On stage, the object's fidgetiness stilled itself. Her posture improved, and of course there was the sheer physical fact of her, the blood-tinged blade that she was, the riot of color that caught everyone's attention. The pan flute stopped, and the hockey field got silent again. People coughed, getting it out of their systems. I peeked out from the curtains and saw the object waiting to go on. She was standing just inside the middle arch, no more than 10 feet from me. I had never seen her so serious before, so concentrated. Talent is a kind of intelligence. As she waited to go on, the obscure object was coming into hers. Her lips moved as if she were speaking Sophocles' lines to Sophocles himself, as if contrary to all intellectual evidence, she understood the literary reasons for their endurance. So the object stood, waiting to go on. Far away from her cigarettes and her snobbishness, her cliquish friends, her atrocious spelling. This was what she was good at. Appearing before people, stepping out and standing there and speaking. She was just beginning to realize it then. What I was witnessing was a self discovering the self it could be. On cue, our Antigone took a deep breath and walked on stage. Her white robe was cinched around her torso with silver braid. The robe fluttered as she stepped out in the warm breeze. "Wilt thou aid this hand to lift the dead?" Maxine Ismene replied, "Thou wouldst bury him when 'tis forbidden to Thebes? I will do my part, and thou wilt not to a brother. False to him will I never be found." I wasn't on for a while. Tiresias wasn't that big a part, so I closed the curtain around me again and waited. I had a staff in my hand. It was my only prop. A plastic stick painted to look like wood. It was then I heard a small, choking sound. Again the object said, "False to him will I never be found," followed by silence. I peeked out the curtain. Through the central arch I could see them. The object had her back to me, farther downstage. Maxine Grossinger stood with a blank look on her face. Her mouth was open, though no words were coming out. Beyond, just above the lip of the stage, was Miss Fagel's florid face whispering Maxine's next line. It wasn't stage fright. An aneurysm had burst in Maxine Grossinger's brain. At first, the audience took her quick stagger and shocked expression to be part of the play. Titters had begun at the way the girl playing Ismene was hamming it up. But Maxine's mother, knowing exactly what pain looked like on her child's face, shot up out of her seat. "No!" she cried. "No!" "20 feet away,
elevated under a setting sun, Maxine Grossinger was still mute. A gurgle escaped from her throat. With the suddenness of a lightning cue, her face went blue. Even in the back rows, people could see the oxygen leave her blood. Pinkness drained away down her forehead, her cheeks, her neck. Later, the obscure object would swear that Maxine had been looking at her with a kind of appeal, that she had seen the light go out of Maxine's eyes. According to the doctors, however, this was probably not true. Wrapped in her dark robe, still on her feet, Maxine Grossinger was already dead. She toppled forward seconds later. Mrs. Grossinger scrambled up on stage. She made no sound now. No one did. In silence, she reached Maxine and tore open her robe. In silence, the mother began to give the daughter mouth to mouth. I froze. I let the curtains untwist and I stepped out and gawked. Suddenly, a white blur filled the arch. The obscure object was fleeing the stage. For a second, I had a crazy idea. I thought Mr. De Silva had been holding out on us. He was doing things the traditional way after all, because the obscure object was wearing a mask. The mask for tragedy. Her eyes, like knife slashes, her mouth a boomerang of woe. With this hideous face, she threw herself on me. "Oh, my God!" she sobbed. "Oh, my God! Kelly!" And she was shaking and needing me. Which leads me to a terrible confession. It is this. While Mrs. Grossinger tried to breathe life back into Maxine's body, while the sun set melodramatically over a death that wasn't in the script, I felt a wave of pure happiness surge through my body. Every nerve, every corpuscle lit up. I had the obscure object in my arms. Tiresias in Love. I made a doctor's appointment for you. I just went to the doctor. Not with Dr. Phil, with Dr. Bauer. Who's Dr. Bauer? He's a lady's doctor. There was a hot bubbling in my chest, as if my heart were eating pop rocks. But I played it cool, looking out at the lake. Who says I'm a lady? Very funny. I just went to the doctor, Mom. That was for your physical. What's this for? When girls get to be a certain age, Callie, they have to go get checked. Why? To make sure everything's okay. What do you mean, everything? Just everything. We were in the car, the second-best Cadillac. When Milton got a new car, he gave Tessie his old one. The obscure object had invited me to spend the day at her club, and my mother was taking me to her house. It was summer now, 2 weeks since Maxine Grossinger had collapsed on stage. School was out. On Middlesex, preparations were underway for our trip to Turkey. Determined not to let Chapter 11's condemnation of tourism ruin our travel plans, Milton was making airplane reservations and haggling with car rental agencies. Every morning he scanned the newspaper, reporting the weather conditions in Istanbul. 81 degrees and sunny. How does that sound, Cal? In response to which I generally twirled an index finger. I wasn't keen on visiting the homeland anymore. I didn't want to waste my summer painting a church. Greece, Asia Minor, Mount Olympus. What did they have to do with me? I just discovered a whole new continent only a few miles away. In the summer of 1974, Turkey and Greece were about to be in the news again. But I didn't pay any mind to the rising tensions. I had troubles of my own. More than that, I was in love. Secretly, shamefully, not entirely consciously, but for all that, quite head over heels in love. Our pretty lake was trimmed in filth, the usual June scum of fish flies. There was also a new guardrail, which gave me a somber feeling as we drove past. Maxine Grossinger wasn't the only girl at school who had died that year. Carol Henkel, a junior, had died in a car accident. One Saturday night, her drunken boyfriend, a guy named Rex Reese, had plunged his parents' car into the lake. Rex had survived, swimming back to shore, but Carol had been trapped inside the car. We passed Baker and Inglis closed for vacation and succumbing to the unreality of schools during summertime. We turned up Kirby Road. The object lived on Tanakor, in a gray stone and clapboard house with a weather vane. Parked on the gravel was an unprepossessing Ford sedan. I felt self-conscious in the second-best Cadillac and got out quickly, wishing my mother gone. When I rang the bell, Beulah answered. She led me to the staircase and pointed up. That was all. I climbed to the second floor. I'd never been upstairs at the object's house before. It was messier than ours, the carpeting not new. The ceiling hadn't been painted in years. But the furniture was impressively old, heavy, and sent out signals of permanence and settled judgment. I tried three rooms before I found the objects. Her shades were drawn, clothes were scattered all over the shag carpeting, and I had to wade through them to reach the bed. But there she was, sleeping, in a Lester Lannan t-shirt. I called her name. I jiggled her. Finally, she sat up against her pillows and blinked. "I must look like shit," she said after a moment. I didn't say whether she did or not. It strengthened my position to keep her in doubt. We had breakfast in the breakfast nook. Beulah served us without elaboration, bringing and taking plates. She wore an actual maid's uniform, black with white apron. Her eyeglasses hailed from her other, more stylish life. In gold script, her name curled across the left lens. Mrs. Object arrived, clacking in sensible heels. "Good morning, Beulah. I'm off to the vet's. Sheba's getting a tooth pulled. I'll drop her back here, but then I'm off to lunch. They say she'll be woozy. Oh, and the men are coming for the drapes today. Let them in and give them the check that's on the counter. Hello, girls. I didn't see you. You must be a good influence, Callie. 9:30 and this one's up already." She mussed the object's hair. "Are you spending the day at the little club, dear? Good. Your father and I are going out with the Peterses tonight. Beulah will leave something for you in the fridge. Bye, all." All this while, Beulah rinsed glasses, keeping to her strategy, giving Gross Point the silent treatment. The object spun the Lazy Susan. French jams, English marmalades, an unclean butter dish, bottles of ketchup, and Lee and Perrin circled past before what the object wanted, an economy-sized jar of Rolaids. She shook out three tablets. "What is heartburn anyway?" I said. "You've never had heartburn?" asked the object, amazed. The Little Club was only a nickname. Officially, the club was known as the Gross Point Club. Though the property was on the lake, there were no docks or boats, only a mansion-like clubhouse, two paddle tennis courts, and a swimming pool. It was beside this pool that we lay every day that June and July. As far as swimwear went, the obscure object favored bikinis. She looked good in them, but by no means perfect. Like her thighs, her hips were on the large size. She claimed to envy my thin, long legs, but she was only being nice. Calliope appeared poolside that first day and every day thereafter in an old-fashioned one-piece with a skirt. It had belonged to Sor Melina during the 1950s. I found it in an old trunk. The stated intent was to look funky, but I was grateful for the full coverage. I also hung a beach towel around my neck or wore an alligator shirt over my suit. The bodice of the bathing suit was a plus two. The cups were rubberized, pointy, and beneath a towel or a shirt gave me the suggestion of a bust I didn't have. Beyond us, pelican-bellied ladies in swim caps followed kickboards back and forth across the pool. Their bathing suits were a lot like mine. Little kids waded and splashed in the shallow end. There is a small window of opportunity for freckled girls to tan. The object was in it. As we revolved on our towels that summer, self-basting, the object's freckles darkened, going from butterscotch to brown. The skin between them darkened too, knitting her freckles together into a speckled harlequin mask. Only the tip of her nose remained pink. The part in her hair flamed with sunburn. Club sandwiches on wave-rimmed plates sailed out to us. If we were feeling sophisticated, we ordered the French dip. We had milkshakes, too, ice cream, French fries. For everything, the object signed her father's name. She talked about Petoskey, where her family had a summer house. "We're going up in August. Maybe you could come up." "We're going to Turkey," I said unhappily. "Oh, right, I forgot." And then, "Why do you have to paint a church? My dad made this promise. How come?" Behind us, married couples were playing paddle tennis. Pennants flew from the clubhouse roof. Was this the place to mention St. Christopher? My father's war stories? My grandmother's superstitions.
You know what I keep thinking, I said.
What?
I keep thinking about Maxine. I can't believe she's dead.
I know.
It doesn't seem like she's really dead. It's like I dreamed it.
The only way we know it's true is that we both dreamed it. That's what reality is. It's a dream everyone has together.
That's deep, said the object.
I smacked her.
Ow!
That's what you get.
Bugs were attracted by our coconut oil. We killed them without mercy.
The object was making a slow, scandalized progress through The Lonely Lady by Harold Robbins. Every few pages, she shook her head and announced, "This book is so dirty." I was reading Oliver Twist, one of the assigned volumes for our summer reading list. Suddenly, the sun went in. A drop of water hit my page, but this was nothing compared to the cascade that was being shaken onto the obscure object. An older boy was leaning over sideways, shaking his wet mop of hair.
"God damn you," she said. "Cut it out."
"What's the matter? I'm cooling you off."
"Quit it."
Finally, he did. He straightened up. His bathing suit had fallen down over his skinny hip bones. This exposed an ant trail of hair running down from his navel. The ant trail was red, but on his head, the hair was jet black.
"Who's the latest victim of your hospitality?" the boy asked.
"This is Callie," said the object. Then to me, "This is my brother, Jerome." The resemblance was clear. The same palette had gone into Jerome's face. Oranges and pale blues primarily, but there was a crudeness to the overall sketch, something bulbous about the nose, the eyes, on the squinty side, pinpricks of light. What threw me at first was the dark, sheenless hair, which I soon realized was dyed.
"You were the one in the play, right?"
"Yes." Jerome nodded. With slitty eyes glinting, he said,
"A thespian, eh? Just like you, right, sis?"
"My brother has a lot of problems," the object said.
"Hey, since you gals are into theater, maybe you want to be in my next film."
He looked at me.
"I'm making a vampire movie."
"You'd make a great vampire."
"I would?"
"Let me see your teeth." I didn't oblige, taking my cue from the object not to be too friendly. "Jerome is into monster movies," she said.
"Horror films," he corrected, still directing his words to me.
"Not monster movies. My sister, as usual, belittles my chosen medium.
Want another title?"
"No," said the object.
"Vampires in Prep School. It's about this vampire, played by moi, who gets sent off to prep school because his affluent but terribly unhappy parents are going through a divorce. Anyway, he doesn't get along too well out there at boarding school. He doesn't wear the right clothes, he doesn't have the right haircut. But then one day, after this kegger, he takes a walk across campus and gets attacked by a vampire. And here's the kicker. The vampire is smoking a pipe. He's wearing a Harris tweed. It's the fucking headmaster, man. So the next morning, our hero wakes up and goes right out and buys a blue blazer and some topsiders and presto, he's a total prep."
"Will you move? You're blocking my son."
"It's a metaphor for the whole boarding school experience," Jerome said. "Each generation puts the bite on the next, turning them into the living dead."
"Jerome has been kicked out of 2 boarding schools."
"And I shall have my revenge upon them," Jerome proclaimed in a hoary voice, shaking his fist in the air.
Then, without another word, he ran to the pool and jumped. As he did, he spun around so he was facing us. There Jerome hung, skinny, sunken-chested, as white as a saltine, his face scrunched up and one hand clutching his nuts. He held that pose all the way down. I was too young to ask myself what was behind our sudden intimacy. In the days and weeks that followed, I didn't consider the object's own motivations, her love vacuum. Her mother had engagements all day long. Her father left for the office at 6:45. Jerome was a brother and therefore useless. The object didn't like being alone. She had never learned to amuse herself. And so one evening at her house, as I was about to get on my bike and ride home, she suggested that I sleep over. "I don't have my toothbrush. You can use mine." "That's gross. I'll get you a new toothbrush. We got a box of them. God, you're such a priss."
I was only feigning squeamishness. In actuality, I wouldn't have minded sharing the object's toothbrush. I wouldn't have minded being the object's toothbrush. I was already well acquainted with the splendors of her mouth. Smoking is good for that. You get a full display of the puckering and the sucking. The tongue often makes an appearance, licking from the lips any stickiness imparted by the filter. Sometimes bits of paper adhere to the bottom lip and the smoke